From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The movie In the Name of the Father has been nominated for 7 Academy Awards, including Best Picture, Best Actor, and Best Director. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we'll hear from the director Jim Sheridan, who also directed My Left Foot, and we'll hear from Jerry Conlon, whose life is the basis of the film. Conlon was wrongly convicted of an IRA bombing. He spent 15 years in prison. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new Steven Seagal film On Deadly Ground. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The United States has expelled a Russian diplomat in connection with the alleged spy scandal that broke this week. A senior Russian intelligence officer has been ordered to leave the country within a week. The Clinton administration had wanted Moscow to voluntarily recall any diplomat who may have been in contact with high-ranking CIA officer Aldrich Ames. Ames and his wife were arrested this week on charges of spying for the former Soviet Union and Russia. President Clinton is condemning today's shootings in a mosque on the West Bank. A Jewish settler killed dozens of Palestinians who were kneeling in Friday prayers. The violence on the West Bank has cast a shadow over the Israeli-Palestinian peace talks. The BBC's Stephen Sacker reports from Cairo.
The Israeli government's perceived failure to protect Palestinian civilians living in the occupied territories has prompted new calls for international intervention. Yasser Arafat himself made a direct appeal to President Clinton. Here in Cairo, the Secretary General of the Arab League, Ismet Abdel-Magid, echoed the call for an international protection force. He accused the Israeli authorities of turning a blind eye to crimes committed against the Palestinians. The Egyptian Foreign Minister Amr Moussa, who's played a vital mediating role in the ongoing negotiations between Israel and the PLO over self-rule, said the massacre in Hebron showed the importance of safeguarding Palestinian security. In Damascus, two radical Palestinian groups, the Popular Front and the Democratic Front, vowed to take vengeance on the Israeli government and Jewish settlers.
Stephen Sacker reporting. U.S. figure skater Tanya Harding has skated her long free program at the Winter Olympics, but she had some trouble getting started. NPR's Mark Schramm has this live update from Hamar, Norway.
Well, Korva, Tanya Harding came out late for her performance tonight. As it turned out, her skate was loose, and she broke down at the beginning of her performance. She tried to do one jump, couldn't complete it. She went off the ice, asked race officials to let her come back and skate later. They allowed her to skate at the end of her group of skaters, and she managed to put a performance together. She composed herself enough to finish. In the meantime, Nancy Kerrigan has just completed a beautiful performance. She hit all of her jumps. She was graceful and wonderful as Kerrigan can be. And it looks like Nancy Kerrigan, barring some other skater topping her, is going to go on to win this competition. Tanya Harding finished her program but will not medal. I'm Mark Schramm in Lillehammer.
Thanks, Mark. The lawyer for Senator Dave Durenberger says the Minnesota Republican will be reindicted on charges of abusing his Senate expense account. Attorney Tom Green says the Justice Department told him the indictment would probably be issued today. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are down half a point at 38.39. This is NPR. A ceasefire between Bosnian Croats and the Bosnian government has taken effect. United Nations monitors say fighting has slackened off, but tension is high. The truce covers the central part of the former Yugoslav Republic and the town of Mostar. It was signed by the Bosnian government military commander and his Bosnian Croat counterpart. The Croatian president now says he accepts the concept of a Croat Muslim federation within Bosnia. He's responding to Western pressure to accept the federation. Dan Rostenkowski, the chair of the powerful House Ways and Means Committee, is fighting a tough Democratic primary battle for his Illinois congressional seat. 3 weeks before the election, Rostenkowski's campaign is getting both a hit and a boost. From Chicago, NPR's Edward Lifson reports.
The Chicago Sun-Times has tracked down 11 of the handcrafted Maplewood chairs Rostenkowski's office has given away as taxpayer-funded gifts over the last 3 years. According to the paper, They went to some of Illinois' most politically connected people. Mayor Daley's brother has one. So does the Cook County Democratic chairman and the president of the Chicago Board of Trade, where two of Rostenkowski's daughters have gotten jobs. Taxpayers paid about $500 for each chair. Last week, the 18-term congressman denied any wrongdoing, but repaid the House door for the chairs and other gifts. On Monday, President Clinton comes to Chicago to campaign for Rostenkowski's re-election. Clinton sees his ally as important to the passage of the health care bill. A poll this week gives Rostenkowski 24% of the vote in a five-way race. In Chicago, I'm Edward Lifson reporting.
The Japanese Transport Ministry says it will send a government inspector to Detroit. The new officer will help speed up American auto exports to Japan. American officials are pressuring Tokyo to simplify its import procedures that keep the Japanese auto market effectively closed to foreign good. The auto trade has gotten attention because it's about two-thirds of the deficit with Japan. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The film In the Name of the Father has been nominated for 7 Academy Awards, including Best Picture, Best Actor, and Best Director. On this archive edition of our show, we're featuring interviews with the director Jim Sheridan and Jerry Conlon, whose autobiography the movie is based on. Our interviews were recorded last month. Jerry Conlon was wrongly convicted of being an IRA terrorist. In the film, Conlon is played by Daniel Day-Lewis. Conlon, who grew up in Belfast, was accused with 3 friends of bombing a pub in Guildford, England. They became known as the Guildford Four. They were sentenced to life in 1975. Conlon's aunt, Annie McGuire, and her family were convicted of making bombs. Conlon's father, who was convicted as a co-conspirator, died in prison in 1980. After his death, there were calls to review the case. It was finally reopened in 1989 after Conlon's lawyer discovered that the prosecution had suppressed evidence which proved Conlon's innocence. I asked Jerry Conlon why he thinks he was accused of the bombing.
I think I was accused of the bombing because the British police were in a state of fear, and Britain had developed the siege mentality down to an IRA mainland campaign. And it was a question of rounding up people, and my name was one of the names that was thrown into the hat, and subsequently I was arrested, and I seemed to fit the bill for them. I came from West Belfast. I was unemployed. They tortured me. I signed a confession.
Why was your name in the hopper? Why was your name on the list?
Well, I was working with some friends in London who happened to be arrested, and they'd been brutalised in the police station, and it had to be seen to be believed, the atmosphere and the amount of brutality that was in the police station, to understand why people could confess to something they didn't do. And obviously these people had been given such a bad time that they admitted something they didn't do. And of course, when you get that sort of situation, it's sort of roller coasters. And to stop the brutality, all sorts of names be threw up, people who they know and people who they know well and people who they know very vaguely.
One of the things you got to understand is that if you were being interrogated and if you knew members of the IRA, and if you were not in the IRA, the last thing you could do is give their names because you're afraid of them. So people were actually looking, when they themselves broke down, they were looking to find people who they thought it was ridiculous would be tried.
So they'd name names that were absurd.
Oh, yeah. Obviously, yeah.
That's why they named Annie McGuire, because her house was decorated with Churchill and Queen
with
of
British
England.
British memorabilia. You right. know, they had Annie McGuire had pictures of the Queen and the bust of Winston Churchill and that. And it was so ludicrous that these people could actually be involved in something like that. And that's how their names were brought up. And it was when you're being tortured and a name crops up, it's very easy to develop it into a real thing.
Jerry Conlon, at your trial, you write in your memoir that you almost thought the defense should have brought up that the IRA didn't want undisciplined idiots like you in its ranks.
The police should have investigated our background before they brought us to trial, and they would have known wouldn't have needed to bring that sort of material up.
What was it about you and the IRA that didn't go together?
Well, probably rock and roll. I grew up in a house that was full of music, and there was a rock and roll background to it. And I don't know, maybe I was sort of like one of the lone hippies where I came from, and all I wanted was a good time, and I didn't perceive a good time to be standing on corners checking out army foot patrols with the possibility of shooting them. I preferred much going to a dance hall or going to the betting shop and having the betting horses and chasing women. You know, that was my priorities. My priorities was never for the United Ireland. I became politicized later on, you know, and it was through imprisonment that happened.
You were also a small-time thief. What did the IRA think of people like you who robbed to get some extra money?
Well, I didn't regard myself. I regarded myself as a small-time survivor. You know, like unemployment was exclusively one-sided where I came from. You know, discrimination in jobs and housing is now well known. But in 1969, it wasn't. So, like, you were having a lot of bombed-out places with all sorts of sellable goods in it. And I thought I was just doing a good job for myself, saying I couldn't get normal employment.
In the movie, there's a scene where someone from the IRA is about to kneecap you, about to shoot you in the knee because you were causing such chaos by stealing. But then in the movie, your father comes in and talks the IRA out of it and rescues you. Did something like that actually happen?
On several occasions. My father was a well-respected member of the community. He was very gentle and very kind, and he was also... For the people who did have a job in West Belfast, he used to fill out the tax forms for them, you know, and he was recognised as a gentle and kind person. And I fell foul of the IRA several times through taking scrap metal to sell from buildings, through what they termed antisocial behaviour, like, and that would come under the term of doing Rod Stewart impressions on the Falls Road, you know.
Doing Rod Stewart impressions would be antisocial behaviour?
Well, if you sang like I did, it would be termed antisocial.
No, what did you and other friends of yours who were apolitical think of the IRA?
We didn't really think anything of them. You know, the whole thing was, it was 1969, Woodstock had happened, there was this whole start of the glam rock era, and all of a sudden you're caught up in a war, you know, and you either joined the IRA or you didn't join the IRA. And my house was full of religious pictures of Jesus Christ and the Blessed Virgin Mary, when most other houses were filled with pictures of 1916 Republican heroes. And I didn't, I had no intention. I was caught up in a rock and roll theme. I was just a young kid who wanted to have a good time, and I found myself walking a precarious tightrope between these two elements who were at war with each other.
So when you were picked up for the Guildford pub bombings, what did the authorities do to you to get you to confess?
Well, the first thing they did was they asked me my name, and when I said my name was Jerry Conlon, this police officer hit me in the face and broke my nose. So that was the start of it. And then I went through a further 6 days of torture. I was beaten every day. I was held naked. The clothes that I was originally arrested in were destroyed by the police because they were saturated with my own blood. And obviously the police had destroyed them because they didn't want them to be exhibited at my court appearance. I was held naked. I was given no food. There was policemen running about with guns. There was Alsatian dogs prowling the corridors. It was a whole time of absolute terror in the police station. I was taken out from the police station. I had a gun put to my head. I was told that my family were going to be murdered. You know, like, it was just incredible. Like, I couldn't believe. When I left Belfast on the plane, I was convinced that I was going to be treated correctly, that English policemen, rather than Northern Ireland policemen, would see how nonsensical this was. You know, like, here was this kid from West Belfast who could be checked out on a computer, whose family had not been touched by the Troubles. There was internment, which meant people were arrested and detained without trial for, it could be anything from a month to 2 or 3 years. And yet my family had never been involved. They had never had their home searched. So, like, if the police just had took a bit of time and checked out our backgrounds, you know, they could have seen, like, how stupid it was arresting the type of people they were arresting. They were arresting people from squats who were like New Age travellers of today.
When you were arrested and interrogated, this was right after the Prevention of Terrorism Act was passed, which enabled the authorities to keep somebody suspected of terrorism for 7 days without legal representation. So that was the period when you were arrested. Can you remember for us the moment when you decided, okay, I'll sign this confession?
When Wally Simmons, the police officer, and Christopher Rowe, who was the assistant chief constable, they picked up the phone and spoke to the policeman who had brutalized me in Springfield Road Police Station and said, Conlon hasn't made a confession. We want an accident to happen to his family. And then they started going on mentioning members of my family. And, like, I knew that the threat was a real one because so many civilians had been killed in such strange circumstances by the security forces, and none of the security forces had ever been held answerable. So, like, I knew that the threat was totally real. And although I was being brutalised within the police station, it was then taken out of my hands. I couldn't deal with the likes of my father, my mother or my sisters being murdered because I wouldn't make a confession. And I thought that the confession would never have stood up in court because of the background I had.
Did you name names, other people's names, when you were asked to confess?
We all named names. We all named the most ludicrous names we could imagine. We named people who were alcoholics, people who were drug addicts. We named every sort of name, you know.
Did you mention your aunt?
I did mention my aunt, you know. And I was only a kid at the time. You've got to remember that we were all 18, 19 and 20 years of age. None of us had ever been in this type of situation before. We were being brutalized. We were being terrified.
Yeah.
We were being held naked. So, like, you had very immature kids, you know?
So your aunt and her family were actually imprisoned for several years and found guilty of being bomb makers, of running a bomb-making factory out of their homes.
That's right. But my other aunt and uncle had been arrested a couple of days previous to that, you know. And the fact is that the police fabricated evidence against my Aunt Annie and my Uncle Paddy and against my father and against my cousins. You know, they went and done a test called the TLC test, the thin layer chromatography test. And once they got the results of that, they said that there was confirmation that they'd been handling explosives, and immediately they burned the samples.
What happens is, basically, we all assume in our own ignorance that if we were in a police station, A, we wouldn't sign a confession,
mm-hmm.
and B, we wouldn't tell on our, you know, friends or whatever. But if most people were terrorized, and it doesn't even have to be such beatings, you know, it can be psychological. Most people would confess. It's something they don't want to admit to. And what happens consequently is we make that act, which is totally understandable, into something wrong. So we're victimizing the victims all over again.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, the frightening thing is not that these people were framed by the police. I can understand that if I can't condone it. But the frightening thing is that the police could think that these people were the IRA, that the police were so blind to, you know, both what the IRA is and what Irish people are, that they thought these ordinary hippies on acid were bombers. It's a frightening concept.
My guest is Jerry Conlon. His autobiography is the subject of the new movie In the Name of the Father, and the film's director, Jim Sheridan, is also with us. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Jerry Conlon. His autobiography is the basis of the new film In the Name of the Father. Director Jim Sheridan is also with us. Jerry, how did your father end up going to prison?
Well, my father had this tremendous love for me, you know, and My mother was the only person in the house who was working at the time, and she couldn't afford to take time off to come and organize the solicitor. But what the thing that's important here is that my father actually went to the police station in Belfast, where I had been detained and beaten, and he got the police to make a call to Scotland Yard that they announced that he was coming over and where he would be staying, which is my aunt's house. And that Scotland Yard police said, yes, of course Mr. Conlon can come over to get legal representation for his son. And when my father arrived in the country, he was in the country 4 hours, and they arrested him. Now, is that the actions of someone who's got something to hide or who's conspiratorial? They actually called Scotland Yard and warned them in advance that he's coming. And what happened was because they needed to build a case. And I think it went a bit further than that. I think it was like the British police send to the Irish community. If you have the IRA in your midst, we are going to find you guilty as well. And therefore, they terrorised a minority community. You know, that's the reality of the situation.
So your father came to visit you and to try to get you good legal representation.
My father came,
and he was picked up when he.
My father came to meet police at Scotland Yard to find out what was happening to me, and he met them in the most bizarre circumstances as a suspect who was then being charged.
So were you on good terms with your father then?
I had the relationship that most young people have with their father, you know, which is a rebellious one. He was the head of the household who laid down laws for the household. And obviously, being a teenager, I rebelled against him from time to time. But there was a great love between me and my father.
So how has your relationship changed when you ended up in jail together?
Well, it went from extreme to extreme, you know. Like, my father believed in one course of action to deal with trying to prove our innocence, and I believed in another. And at times we came into conflict about it. But, like, there was always this love, and I got to see my father beyond the superficial father that most children see. I got to know him as a human being. I got to see a spiritual side of him, and I got to be able to dip from the well of strength that he had inside him, you know.
In your book, you write that before your father died, he said to you, and your father died in prison. When he got to prison, he had, I think, tuberculosis and a heart condition. So he was
he hadn't got a heart condition.
My father,
the thing is, my father would have probably been alive today if it hadn't have been for the maltreatment in prison. You know, like, if you had treated a dog in the fashion that the British prison authorities treated my father, you would have been indicted. My father was treated brutally at the hands of the British.
You write that your father said to you before he died, my death is going to clear your name, then you clear mine. Did his death have an effect on your case?
I think the death of my father reopened this case. It drew enormous interest to the case, and I think my father's death was instrumental in my release. And I think since I've been out of prison, I've campaigned ferociously on behalf of innocent victims of miscarriages of justice, and not only in the Irish community, but in the black community, in the Asian community. And I have gone out and told the world what's happened to my father, and I'm just trying to do my best now for other people who are left behind in prison suffering the same injustice.
So you think even in death your father was helping you?
Oh, I know in death. My father gave his life to not only clear my name, but to clear the names of the likes of Annie McGuire in that door. Without my father's death, this case would never have been reopened.
Annie McGuire,
he gave the ultimate sacrifice.
In your book, you write, I'd gone away as a kid, an absolute menace. I came out of prison more mature. How did you mature in prison?
Well, I think 15 years anywhere. Like,
yeah, really? Age,
yeah, I think, like, yeah, no matter where you are, I think if you're in a zoo, you mature to some extent, you know, to some extent.
Yeah.
And what happened was I started educating myself while I was in prison, no thanks to the prison authorities, I might add, but through my family sending me in books and all sorts of reading material and newspapers and that they sacrificed bits of their savings for. And I think it was just a growing up process. It's a very difficult place to become mature. But it happens to everyone. You do become mature. Time's the master.
Three of your friends, plus your aunt and her family, were imprisoned for many years.
Mm-hmm.
Did they all survive emotionally? and physically?
No, I think everybody's been deeply scarred by this trauma. And I, you know, my lawyer in England took me to a psychologist, and she said it'll take 20 years for the scars to sort of heal in this situation. And everyone's deeply scarred, but the situation's developing because of this film. Like, what the British press are trying to do is pit victim against victim, you know, which is a real sad state of affairs when you have people who have been acknowledged to have been brutalised and went through some of the worst conditions imaginable in that country, and then use them as a scapegoat to justify your own institutions.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jerry Conlon, and he is the subject of the new film In the Name of the Father, which stars Daniel Day-Lewis as Jerry Conlon. Jerry Conlon and several of his friends and family were basically framed for the bombing of two London pubs in, was it 1974?
It was 1974, and it wasn't basically framed, it was totally framed.
Thank you. And there was evidence that corroborated their story that was suppressed by
the
prosecution.
There was evidence the whole way through the thing. It was from the day after my arrest, the forensic and after scenes policemen had material at their fingertips that suggested they had got the wrong people. And even during my trial, the people who actually bombed Guildford and Woolwich left a bomb in Margaret Thatcher's constituency, which was an absolute replica of the bomb that they placed in Guildford without a detonator. And the forensic people who had just given evidence the day before on behalf of the prosecution in my case went and examined that bomb and then wrote a thesis saying that the people who have done the Guildford and Woodledge pub bombings are still at large, and they did not reveal that evidence to our defence. The police acted totally dishonourable, and so did the defence, or so did the prosecution in our case.
And even when the real bombers confessed to the bombing,
the real,
it was ignored.
When the Balcombe Street people were arrested, they were asked by the heads, Jim Neville, Peter Imbert, in the interrogation, what was the first bombings you did in this country? And they said, the first bombings we did in this country, you've put innocent people in prison for. And they proceeded to give an enormous amount of detail. The police chose to do nothing about that. When the Balcombe Street people then got in touch with an MP, they were charged with Guildford and Woolwich and were charged for several months. They were then taken to a special court hearing where the charges, seven murder charges, were then dropped against them, with the statement from the DPP, who is your equivalent of your DA, stating that they did not want to burden the jury with too many charges. They then kept in several complex conspiracy charges, which those people were found not guilty of. The Balcombe Street people, or the IRA unit, then used their trial as a platform to highlight the injustice it had suffered us and the corruption of the British police and the British judiciary. And on the basis of that, we were given an appeal.
Jerry, you've said that you don't want to go through your whole life just being known as one of the Guildford Four. What have you been doing lately?
I've been campaigning. 2 weeks after I got out of prison, I was in Washington campaigning on behalf of other victims of injustice.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I've been doing. But I feel that, or I felt that I had to fulfill my father's promise, which was to let the world know what had happened to him. And the two mediums for doing that is literature and the cinema. After this movie's over, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I will always be involved in human rights issues, that's for sure, because I know what it's like to fall foul of the law when you're innocent.
Jerry Conlon. His memoir is the basis of the film In the Name of the Father, which has been nominated for 7 Academy Awards, including Best Actor for Daniel Day-Lewis's portrayal of Jerry Conlon. Our interview was recorded last month. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. We'll hear from director Jim Sheridan in the second part of the show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Jim Sheridan is up for an Academy Award for directing the film In the Name of the Father, which Sheridan also co-wrote. The film is based on the story of Jerry Conlon, who was wrongly convicted of being an IRA terrorist. Coming up on this archive edition of Fresh Air, we'll feature an interview with Sheridan about the making of In the Name of the Father. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews On Deadly Ground, the new Steven Seagal film. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Clinton administration has expelled a senior diplomat at the Russian embassy in Washington after Moscow refused to voluntarily withdraw him. The State Department says Alexander Lysenko was in a position to be responsible for an alleged spy who worked for the CIA in a high-ranking position. Aldrich Ames and his wife were arrested this week on espionage charges. The United States wanted all Russian diplomats who may have been in contact with them to go home. But since Russia did not act, Washington has given Lysenko 7 days to leave. President Clinton has denounced a shooting massacre in a mosque today in the West Bank. A gunman opened fire at Friday prayers in the town of Hebron today.
On behalf of the American people, I condemn this crime in the strongest possible terms. I am outraged and saddened that such a gross act of murder could be perpetrated, and I extend my deepest sympathies to the families of those who have been killed and wounded. I also call on all the parties to exercise maximum restraint in what we all understand is a terribly emotional situation.
Scores of people died when a Jewish settler fired in the mosque. Scores others were wounded. Another 19 Palestinians were killed in the ensuing rioting. Negotiators for Israel and the PLO are still working on implementing the Palestinian self-rule agreement, but a shadow has fallen over the talks. A truce between Bosnian Muslim and Croats is reportedly holding. The ceasefire signed Wednesday at the peace talks in Zagreb. They're scheduled to begin again this weekend. The BBC's Kathy Jenkins reports from Zagreb.
Only recently, a handshake between Croatian President Franjo Tudjman and his Serbian counterpart Slobodan Milosevic seemed to signal a Serb-Croat rapprochement and more pressure on the Muslims. The dynamics have quickly changed. This weekend, Croat and Muslim leaders will meet in Washington to discuss a Croat-Muslim agreement for Bosnia. A few weeks ago, the UN gave President Tudjman a deadline to withdraw from Bosnia the regular Croatian army troops fighting alongside the Bosnian Croats. The deadline was overshadowed by events in Sarajevo. Nevertheless, President Tudjman knew what hung on it. If he complied, he could have Western support, investment, and the prospect of entry at some point into the European institutions which Croatia so covets.
Kathy Jenkins reporting. The agent for actor Garrett Morris says the comedian is in serious condition, recovering from a gunshot wound. Authorities say Morris was shot and wounded yesterday during a robbery attempt. A police spokeswoman says Morris was hit once in the arm and once in the chest. Stock prices were mixed today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell just more than a point to end at 3838.78. This is NPR. Former Housing Department staffer Deborah Gore Dean has been sentenced to 21 months in prison and fined $5,000. She was convicted on 12 counts of defrauding the government, taking a payoff, and lying to Congress. Her bids for a new trial and an acquittal were rejected 2 weeks ago. Dean was an executive assistant to Housing Secretary Samuel Pierce. She was depicted during her trial as a person who directed millions of dollars to housing projects that benefited politically connected Republicans. Jurors deliberating the World Trade Center bombing case have taken the day off. The trial, which lasted 5 months, stemmed from the bombing 1 year ago tomorrow. Steve Inskeep of member station WBGO reports.
It was a Friday like this one that an explosion ripped through a parking garage beneath New York's tallest buildings, killing 6 people. As choking smoke shot through the 107-floor towers, workers struggled down dark stairwells and stood outside the building, stunned.
It was on 36th floor. We're on the 36th floor. And we heard the blast explosion.
And a building just shook.
And the lights went out. And it was like thunder, more than thunder, just lightning that hit the building and just everything was shaken. I mean, it's scary.
Today, most of the Trade Center is open again, including the parking garage where the explosion took place. Just a few blocks away, four defendants in the case are awaiting the results of a five-month-long trial. For National Public Radio, I'm Steve Inskeep reporting.
Zulu leader Mangosuthu Buthelezi plans to talk with African National Congress leader Nelson Mandela and the South African government. Observers say Buthelezi could be close to altering his rejection of upcoming national elections. The Inkatha leader and his white rightist allies say they cannot participate in the balloting because the new constitution ignores their demands for ethnic self-determination. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In the first part of our show, we heard from Jerry Conlon, who was wrongly convicted in England of being an IRA terrorist, along with his friend Paul Hill, his aunt Annie McGuire, and his father. Conlon's autobiography is the basis of the film In the Name of the Father. The film has been nominated for an Academy Award for Best Picture. My guest Jim Sheridan wrote and directed the film. He's nominated for Best Director. The film stars Daniel Day-Lewis as Conlon. Emma Thompson plays the lawyer who reopens the case and proves their innocence. Thompson's and Lewis's performances were nominated for Oscars, too. Director Jim Sheridan and actor Daniel Day-Lewis had worked together before on the film My Left Foot. In the Name of the Father is as much about a father-son relationship as it is about politics. In this scene, Conlon's father, played by Peter Postlethwaite, has just been imprisoned as part of the bombing conspiracy. Jerry, who had in the past rebelled against his father, feels both angry and guilty about his father's imprisonment, but he's still rebelling against his father.
Why are you looking at me like that?
What?
Why are you looking at me like that?
Like what?
Why do you always follow me? Huh? Why do you always follow me when I do something wrong? Why can't you follow me when I do something right?
What are you talking about?
Huh? What am I talking about? I'm talking about the medal.
What medal?
The medal I won at football. And you could only see what I was doing wrong. I could never do anything good enough for you. And after the game, you came up to me and you said, Jerry, did you foul the ball?
This is shock.
And that's when I started the rob. The proof that I was no good.
I asked Jim Sheridan why he wanted to make a film about Jerry Conlon.
Lots of things, but to round out just the conversation with Jerry and to show you the kind of anger where I was coming from, Jerry got out of prison and his lawyer, Garrett Pierce, asked that they be given psychotherapy. And the only people who did this were the RAF, I think. And they said they couldn't do it because of the IRA connection. And Garrett Pierce said, well, you did it for the hostages from Beirut. And these people repeated and said, we can't do it because of the IRA connection. Now, Garrett Pierce then pointed out to them that these had been cleared in the court of any connection, but that didn't work. So the only healing that's been done is by my film. There's no apologies coming from the other side, and there's no sense of wanting to heal this case. All they have to say is they're sorry. And Peter Imbert, who Jerry mentioned as getting the information from the IRA that they did the bombing, retired as head of the Metropolitan Police as Sir Peter Imbert. So you have that on the one hand, and on the other, these poor... Jerry is in many ways still 20. Paul Hill is still 20. Annie McGuire is very angry at Jerry, understandably in certain regards, but I think wrongly. And, you know, nobody is looking at the overall situation and saying, how come you change things by first apologising for the wrong. So nobody had apologised and nobody, and the Court of Appeal was dragging on and nothing was happening. And I saw this story and then I saw the fact that Jerry's father followed him. And that really crowned it for me. I saw this man who was like Orpheus in the underworld going in after his son into hell to try and rescue him. And he gets pulled into the vortex and pulled down. And then I thought, this is amazing. It's like a fairy tale, but it's different to a fairy tale because fairy tales end happily. And in this case, Giuseppe didn't get out. He died inside. That's the only difference.
The story in the movie focuses in a fascinating way about the father, Giuseppe, and the son, Jerry Conlon. Mm-hmm. And in the movie, Jerry Conlon sees his father as meek and as something of an embarrassment. And he sees his father's lack of confidence as responsible for a lot of Jerry's own problems. Jerry Conlon's book doesn't focus on the father-son relationship nearly to the extent that your movie does. Did a lot of that come from talking to Jerry, or is a lot of that stuff that you added in for dramatic reasons?
Well, it's a combination, you know. Because I wanted a father-son story, and once I focused that, I asked Jerry an awful lot of questions, you know, as you can imagine. Like, we spent weeks and weeks together before I start filming. And I drew certain of the facts from Jerry, and I kind of tried to pull it out of him. And you must understand that there were a lot of things Jerry didn't want to face, you know. I mean, his father was in jail, not because of him, because of the authorities. But somewhere, you know, you have to hold yourself responsible. Mm-hmm. So Jerry had this, like, well of, like, guilt to deal with. And I didn't want to add to that, and I certainly didn't want to victimize him again. And I think that, you know, in very many strange ways, we have become close in a funny way. We've argued and fought, just like Giuseppe and Jerry, just like Jerry with his own father and the characters in the film. So, and in other ways, Jerry has taught me things. So between me and Jerry, the relationship is like, you know, I suppose, brotherly, father and son, argumentative. And that's the way you can't draw a clear line. So I took quite a bit from my own relationship with my own father emotionally and tied it to Jerry's story. But, you know, and fathers and sons are the same the world over. So it's a combination of, you know, forcing Jerry to tell me a bit more and drawing on my own stuff.
Daniel Day-Lewis plays the part of Jerry Conlon. You worked together in My Left Foot.
Mm-hmm.
Was he immediately enthusiastic about taking on this role, or did you have to talk him into it?
Yeah, I had to talk him into it. You know, it's, you know, basically, like, if you're an actor, it's worse even than a director. I get people ringing me up and they're giving me scripts and their life will change, you know, is their concept if you do the script. So it becomes this terrible onus on you to read this stuff, and you read it and it doesn't even make it past page 5. And, you know, they've spent months working on it. So that's what it's like for actors, mostly reading scripts. So I was very careful not to give Daniel a script and to let him get the full impact of the story. And I told him the story. I prefer to tell stories than...
Are you very good at that? Are you very good at putting a story across?
Well, I think we, you know, the Irish have that thing of being good at stories. I'm not sure that it's such a... It's a great talent in certain regards, but it's also a very dangerous one. But I am good at, yes, telling stories. But I then, you know, and then I would involve Daniel in meeting Jerry and whatever. And then Daniel was offered another few films, you know, where he would earn 3 times the amount of money. And, you know, it was the same with myself. You know, I could have earned an awful lot more by doing a, you know, commercial film. But we just decided that this was more important and we should do it. But we don't want to be clapped on the back for that, you know, because it's really painful to be doing films that are just commercial and, you know, you're into. And, you know, it's a hard medium if you're sensitive in certain regards, because you're getting up every day to try and push this stuff that you don't believe in along. So once you get something you believe in, you'll do it for, you know, a tenth of the price and feel 10 times as good about it. But, you know, I think, we were happy to do it.
My guest is Jim Sheridan, director of In the Name of the Father. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with director and screenwriter Jim Sheridan. Are you still living in Ireland?
I'm living in Dublin now. I lived in America for 7 or 8 years, but mm-hmm. now I live in Ireland. Yeah.
Well, what kind of impact has your film had in Ireland?
You know, every time somebody asks you a question like what kind of impact it has, if you say that it's going to be, it's either going to be second to Jurassic Park or it's going to surpass it, you know, it sounds like it's a boast. But it has a huge impact in Ireland. I think it has an impact for, I think in many ways it has a very healthy impact because it confronts the situation openly up front and it says a lot of things that needed to be said. And it says them in a non-violent way. And people need that. That's the stories that need to be told. The Irish story has never been told. The writers, news agency, has controlled the world media, and especially America, since the Second World War. And, you know, Americans have and British interests have been very similar, very close for all that time. I think basically until the collapse of Russia. And I think you'll find that a lot of regional conflicts changed our perspective now that the Russian threat is no longer there.
Is your father still alive?
No, he died about a week ago.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry to hear that.
yeah,
Had he seen the movie? I was just wondering, it sounds like you worked out a lot of your feelings about your relationship with your father in the film.
Yeah. Well, of course I did, you know what I mean? Up to I did that film, there was a tape running in my head, you know, which was that all fathers were bullies and tough and, you know, that's the Irish father figure as portrayed in literature by the writers. And I don't care if we have genius writers in Ireland. I think it's a bullshit story. Most fathers are quite good. My father, of course, I had some small arguments with him. I had, you know, grown up rows when I was 17. But even now, like, when I read the papers, like, it's like as if I was fighting him all the time. And, you know, the truth of the matter was, most of the times I got on with him, and there was a truce, I suppose, you know, in many ways. Until lately, when I told him I was doing this film, or just before that, and we talked about my brother, one of my brothers who died, and we got a lot closer. And then when I started to make the film, he was very happy, because somewhere deep down, all the father figures were him. And on the premiere night in Dublin, he was over the moon, totally happy. And it was like a reconciliation, this film. It was quite strange, actually, you know, to be burying your father when you had this film out called In the Name of the Father.
Had he been sick when you were making it?
No, not at all, really. It was a surprise thing. He was always well. He got terminal pneumonia. But I suppose, you know, in many ways, you know, good things come out of interior change, you know. And once I decided I was going to make a story about a good father, you know, it's like an antennae. You pick up the story out there. So like Jerry and, you know, if any, although an awful lot of bad came out of the Guildford story, at least one, you know, me and my dad and whatever that, you know, reconciliation. It wasn't like an earth-shattering thing, but it was nice for me to have before he died. And if it heals in other ways, this story, you know, it'll be great. And I think that a healing process needs to start. But the English and the British have never contextualized the means within which Northern Ireland can be healed. Now, if it takes us to contextualize it, if it takes the victims at last to fight back and put a new context, then so be it. But you realize, and you, if you ask any victims out there, be they women who are raped, be they children who are abused, be they nations that are abused, in the end, it's the victims that frame the healing process, not the victimizers. The victimizers only see that they're right. That they have to hold that, otherwise they collapse into self-hatred. And we don't want that to happen in relation to England. We actually think that you need a healing framework for the future. You need to visualise a future with peace. And we'll fight the IRA. You know, I mean, our film takes a stand against the IRA. And nobody has come up to us and said, you know, well done in England to that. They've only attacked us for bringing us the truth to light.
Has making this film made you more political?
Yes, it has in certain regards. It's made me more positively anti-violence, you know, but it's made me realise that violence occurs. It's an inadequate means of dialogue, violence. It happens when people decide to vent their anger in horrific, obscene ways, or when they feel that they're not allowed to vent it in other ways. And I think it's a sad situation more than anything, you know. It's like, it's just a very, and we feel in Ireland, you know, that 99% of Irish people are non-violent. In fact, the least violent race in the world in many ways. You know, they say the fighting Irish. That's only because the rest of Europe robbed the world for hundreds of years. We were the only ones that didn't. And every 40 or 50 years, five or 10 people died fighting England or whatever. And they were called the fighting Irish because of that. So when the people who colonized the world framed the debate, they put words attached to us. I don't want those words to be attached to the Irish anymore. I realise in many ways that, you know, the Irish are like children also, you know. But children grow up and it's time we grew up, you know. I do feel that. And it's time, you know, the Irish in America got on the side of trying to build a peaceful framework and get the Catholic population of Northern Ireland, who are 20 to 50% unemployed, some work. You know, we need a new framework rather than the old trotted out cliches that have been coming out for the last 50 years. I don't know. I suppose I am political.
Jim Sheridan co-wrote and directed In the Name of the Father. It's been nominated for 7 Academy Awards, including Best Director and Best Film. This is Fresh Air. I have a rundown of some of the stories coming up on All Things Considered. We'll hear the latest news on the events in the Middle East, on the ground and on the diplomatic front, following today's massacre of Muslim worshippers at a mosque in the West Bank town of Hebron. They'll have reaction from the PLO and the Israeli government, and a report on how this may affect the peace talks. Also, a profile of the gunman, 42-year-old Baruch Goldstein, who emigrated from Brooklyn, New York, to Israel. And the latest on the women's skating finals in Lillehammer. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. After his movies Hard to Kill and Under Siege, Steven Seagal was such a powerful star that Warner Brothers actually let him direct his latest film. But then they balked. Seagal wanted to end the film with a 10-minute environmentalist lecture. Warners said no. Seagal insisted. What was the result? Film critic Stephen Schiff tells us in his review of On Deadly Ground.
First of all, the lecture's there, but it clocks in at under 4 minutes. I timed it. I didn't have that much else to do. Besides, it's not that lecture that gets you, it's the other lectures. On Deadly Ground is the kind of movie in which Steven Seagal interrupts a barroom brawl he's right in the middle of to ask his adversary, what does it take to change the essence of a man? To which the big lug he's fighting dolefully replies, I need time to change. I think it's a Zen thing. The movie's an environmentalist thriller set in a gorgeous Alaskan landscape, and Seagal plays a man called Forrest. Don't worry, the other characters aren't named Sea and Sky. Forrest fights oil fires for a living, but now he's working for a big polluting oil company called Aegis. It's spelled like Aegis, but hey, if you're Steven Seagal, who's going to tell you you need a dictionary? Now, Aegis is run by evil Michael Caine. He spends the movie wearing fake auburn hair and steely contact lenses and what look like bright artificial teeth, the better to chew up the scenery with. This is his doggiest performance in years. Caine is building the world's biggest oil well, called Aegis I, and he's using defective parts because he doesn't have time to wait for good ones. If he doesn't get Aegis I built fast enough, the property rights will revert to the Inuit tribe that inhabits the land. Once Seagal finds out about all this and lodges a protest, Caine tries to have him killed, but the Inuits find his wounded body and nurse him back to health. Then they put him through all sorts of rituals, invoking bird gods and animal spirits, Suddenly, the movie turns into dances with polar bears. Naturally, Seagal befriends the tribal chief and his beautiful daughter, played by Joan Chen. Here she is telling him he shouldn't be such a violent person.
Blowing up Aegis One is not the answer, Forrest. There are enough dead bodies. Let's leave it to the authorities. I know the press. Let's contact the press. Have you learned anything from my father?
What do you want me to learn, Masu? I mean, do you really think that this hocus-pocus spirit stuff is going to help us now? What do you think? Some angel is going to miraculously come down out of the sky and stop, say, 350 billion tons of oil from being spilled into our oceans every year? Maybe some ghost will stop all the cars from using gasoline. Maybe somehow some spirit will trip the big switch and all the technology that's been repressed for the last 70 years will suddenly be ours and it'll be a better place to live, a beautiful place.
I just want to interrupt here to say that Steven Seagal directs almost as powerfully as he acts. The movie's full of inept camera placement, cuts that come at the wrong times, strange distorting lenses, and some of the slowest fight scenes ever staged. There's also a considerable amount of hero worship. Half the dialogue is devoted to telling the audience how tough Seagal is. And when Kane employs an entire mercenary army to chase him, they keep shaking their heads and saying, "Man, he's good." But that's not what really matters.
Now, what really matters is the cold, hard reality of this world, and that's what we got to deal with. I didn't want to resort to violence.
Still going.
I don't have a choice, and I'm not taking any chances.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Roberta Shurock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
How will the massacre of Muslim worshippers at a mosque in the West Bank affect the peace process between Israel and the PLO? On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Milton Viorst, Middle East correspondent for The New Yorker and author of the new book Sandcastles, The Arabs in Search of the Modern World. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.